The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand. Not the curtains at his feet, nor the curtains at his back, but those to which his face was addressed. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, and Scrooge, starting up into a half-recumbent attitude, found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor who drew them, as close to it as I am now to you, and I am standing in the spirit at your elbow. My margin notes on Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. We're in stave two, the first of the three spirits to come and visit. Scrooge has been told that the first spirit would come to see him at the strike of one. His dear friend Jacob Marley warned him of this. And there's a confusing time pattern that follows. He wakes up at 12, but he knows that it was past 2 when he went to bed. And now he's waking up again, and he's listening to the chimes of the clock and waiting and waiting. If you've ever had those clocks that chime every quarter hour, we had one when I was little. It was a cuckoo clock that would cuckoo at the quarter past and twice at half past and three times at three quarters past, and then the hour itself. So Scrooge is awake listening to this ding-dong, a quarter past, and ding-dong, half past. Ding dong, a quarter to it, said Scrooge. Ding dong, the hour itself, said Scrooge triumphantly, and nothing else. Dickens builds up this little bit of tension the way that I would be listening in my bed when I was little, and usually I would fall asleep before the next chime happened. But Scrooge is awake, and he's ready. He's at this anticipatory moment, ready for anything to happen, and a little bit smug that it seemed that nothing happened, until the bed curtain was drawn aside. The bed curtain was drawn aside, and the spirit is standing as close as I am to you. We get this lovely little author address here in the middle. This feeling that as we're reading this story, somebody is right over our shoulder reading it along with us. And here we have the spirit of Christmas past. Now, at this point, Dickens is charged with creating a character of someone or something that hasn't been created before. He needs to come up with a character who is the absolute embodiment of Christmas. Now, this is 100 years before some marketing genius would come up with the jolly fat Saint Nicholas of the Coca-Cola ads, but Dickens isn't looking for a jolly old Saint Nicholas or a Father Christmas. He wants Christmas itself. He wants the embodiment of the one for whom this day is recognized. He wants Christ. He wants that we worship and acknowledge for the time. Now, most nativity scenes, well, all nativity scenes, we'll just say that. When we think of Christmas and we think of Jesus, we think of the infant Jesus. We think of the baby Jesus born to Mary. If you look at paintings, and I'm not an art expert, so don't ding me on my dates, but 15th, 16th, 17th century paintings, when artists have to create these iconic images for churches and cathedrals to show the Mother Mary and the Christ child, and this is used for religious instruction as much as it is for the aesthetics of art. And trying to capture God incarnate in a baby. And a lot of these real classic paintings, their solution was to have a pretty homely baby. Something with a baby's proportions, little chubby arms, little chubby legs, sitting on a lap. But the face would be the face of an old man with these world-weary, wise eyes and an old man's hairline and just this expression of of age and weight, the weight of knowledge and the weight of existence and the weight of eternity. Dickens does not go that route, but he does take on all of those paradoxes that come along with having God incarnate as a human. He writes, "It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as an old man." So there again, it's a child, but it's an old man at the same time. This is another reason why to read the novel and not just rely on movie adaptations to really get what Dickens was going for, because the way that he has described this spirit, as far as I've seen, has never been perfectly captured on film, and it would be hard to. But moving on. Not so like a child as like an old man, viewed through some supernatural medium, which gave him the appearance of having receded from the view and being diminished to a child's proportions. What Dickens is describing here is a figure that seems to have been shrunk down from adult proportions, shrunk to a child's proportions, but a child's size remaining that the same ratio proportionality of an adult, which I find fascinating too, because he's doing this before we had shrunken images on any kind of film, before we had any kind of film. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it, and the tenderest bloom was on the skin. So again, he has long gray hair, but a fresh, unwrinkled, unlined face. Says the arms were very long and muscular, and the hands the same, as if its hold were of uncommon strength. Its legs and feet, most delicately formed, were like those upper members, bare. He has strong arms and strong hands that are, you picture them muscled, you picture them just well formed, but he's wearing something that bears his arms and bears his legs, and that is a garment that a child would wear. No adult, and certainly not an adult in Dickens' time of writing this, no adult man is going to be walking around in any kind of a garment that would bear his arms and his legs. It wore a tunic of purest white, and round its waist was bound a lustrous belt, the sheen of which was beautiful. It held a branch of fresh green holly in its hand. And in a singular contradiction of that wintry emblem, had its dress trimmed with summer flowers. This is, I think, my favorite little set of images here that really shows the contradiction and the duality of this Christ image in this story. Holding a sprig of holly, holly is long associated symbolically with Jesus himself, the prickly green leaves, the green showing eternity and eternal life, but they were prickly like the thorns in his crown, the little red berries like the droplets of blood. And we use holly all the time in our Christmas decorating because of that evergreen nature of it. But the dress of this spirit is trimmed in summer flowers, and nothing could be more opposite of a sprig of holly than a summer flower. Summer flower has a very finite lifespan. It lasts for a summer. It's very delicate. It's very easily crushed and killed. And Jesus on earth had a finite time as a human. It was one season. It was 33 years. So it was here we have eternity and this finite season together associated with the same character. He writes, but the strangest thing about it was that from the crown of its head there sprung a bright, clear jet of light by which all this was visible, and which was doubtless the occasion of its using, in its duller moments, a great extinguisher for a cap which it now held under its arm. So the most distinctive feature is this light that's emanating from the crown, emanating from the spirit himself. And it's this light that is illuminating the room. Scrooge has no light in his quarters. The room is dark. It's the middle of the night. It's the spirit who is bringing light into this room. And he has an extinguisher for a cap that right now he's holding under his arm. We're going to get back to that cap and that light in just a minute. But the paragraph that follows, if y'all ever had a chance to look over my shoulder and see the notes that I have in my margins written all around my book, some of them are wonderfully articulate with reference to other pieces of literature and allusions to art and all of this stuff. But this paragraph that follows, I am just going full disclosure and telling you the only thing I have written next to it in my book is the phrase crazy snacks. Crazy snacks is my own personal idiom for things that are just bizarre and strange and weird. And the paragraph that follows is all of those things. It's bizarre and strange and weird. It's a time-traveling Dickens who is shrinking down characters and recording voices before anybody else was doing that, also gives us this incredibly psychedelic disco moment with this spirit. This is just nuts. He writes, even this, referring to the cap, even this, though, when Scrooge looked at it with increasing steadiness, was not its strangest quality. For as its belt sparkled and glittered now in one part and now in the other, and what was light one instant at another time was dark, so the figure itself fluctuated in its distinctness, being now a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, now a head without a body, of which dissolving parts no outline would be visible in the dense gloom wherein they had melted away. And in the very wonder of this, it would be itself again, distinct and clear as ever. So just think about your craziest Christmas light display with the lights blinking on and off in different colors. That's what this spirit was doing. Its belt was blinking on and off in different colors. Again, this is before lights ever blinked. This is before lights had color. This is before lights were happening. Its belt was blinking in these crazy colors, and this full-on animation of multiple legs, then no legs, then a head, and then only a head and legs and no body. This crazy snacks display of the spirit in front of Scrooge. And it's like he's just sort of spinning and showing off, and Scrooge just doesn't know what to think. This is something so unfamiliar to him that his mind isn't even really processing what he's seeing. It's a hallucination to him that needs to be made real. And as we go through this next, in my book, this next page, we'll see where it becomes real. Scrooge asks, "Are you the spirit whose coming was foretold to me?" And the spirit says, "I am." And Dickens described the voice as being soft and gentle, singularly low, as if instead of being so close beside him, it were at a distance. So it's like the words are coming from a distant place, but are also right there in the room. He's describing a recording, that these are words that are being magnified from a distance, but then brought to where the spirit is the mouthpiece for them. He says, "Who and what are you?" "I am the ghost of Christmas past." "Long past?" inquired Scrooge. And the spirit says, "No, your past." And perhaps Scrooge could not have told anybody why, if anybody could have asked him, but he had a special desire to see the spirit in his cap and begged him to be covered. Scrooge is bathed now, standing in this light that is coming from this spirit. And he doesn't know why, but he just knows that he needs the spirit to cap his light, to cover it. If it's his conscience, if it's his fear, if it's his feeling of unworthiness of being there. And he says, you know, to please cover. And the ghost exclaims, no. He says, would you so soon put out with those worldly hands the light I give? Is it not enough that you are one of those whose passions made this cap and forced me through whole trains of years to wear it low upon my brow? Like, how dare you ask me to cover up this light when you're the type of person, you're one of those people who make it so difficult for it to shine at all. You're the ones who make it so I have to wear it low because it can't get out to where it needs to be. And then Scrooge backs off. And he asks the ghost, why are you here? And the ghost says, for your welfare. And Scrooge makes a joke to himself saying, maybe a night of unbroken rest would be better for his welfare. And even though he doesn't say it out loud, the spirit hears him. So here's the omniscience of Christ, that this is a spirit who can read Scrooge's thoughts. And he changes his reply. He says, well, then for your reclamation, take heed. Right? For your reclamation, your reclaiming, we are going to go into your past and we are going to take your life and take it back from what it has become, from whatever it was that has brought you to this place. We are reclaiming what you have. That's not all in the text. Again, those are my notes. So this evening, it's you know, the middle of the night, it's the middle of December, middle of the winter. Scrooge is standing at the middle of a window on a second or third floor. And when the spirit says, rise and walk with me, it says he puts out its strong hand and clasps him gently by the arm. So there's that duality again, okay, a strong hand and a gentle grasp. And later in the next paragraph, he says he compares it to a woman's touch. So the grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. The spirit's not going to drag him, grab him. He invites him. And Scrooge is, of course, terrified. He says, I'm mortal. I might fall. And this is, again, this is why we need to read the book. I hope you're reading the book along with this. You just owe it to yourself because there's all of these fantastic little moments that don't quite make it into the adaptation. The spirit has this soft but strong grip on Scrooge's arm, strong enough that he's not going to let him fall, but soft enough that he's not going to drag him. It's still going to have to be Scrooge's decision to make that first step, but he's in the safety of that grip. But then the spirit goes on and says, bear but a touch of my hand there, said the spirit, laying it upon his heart, and you shall be upheld in more than this. The spirit touches Scrooge's heart. So it's not just a matter of you'll be safe flying through the air with me. But he's saying if you'll bear a touch of my hand on your heart, If you will let me touch your heart, you'll be upheld in more than this. This is nothing compared to the strength that you will have if you will bear a touch to your heart from me. And when I think about this spirit, this embodiment of Christ, all of these things, the eternity of him and the strength of him and the protection of him touched to Scrooge's heart. It's just a way of looking at the story that you just never get in the movies. I'm Allison Whitman. That's the secret of next time on Margin Notes.